5. In standard American English, the word with the most gradations of meaning is probably run. The Random House Unabridged Dictionary offers 178 options, beginning with to go quickly by moving the legs more rapidly than at a walk, and ending with melted or liquefied. In the crescent colors of the borderlands between Midworld and Thunderclap, the blue ribbon for most meanings would have gone to Kamala. If the word were listed in the Random House Unabridged, the first definition, assuming they were assigned, as is common, in order of widest usage, would have been a variety of rice grown at the furthermost eastern edge of all world. The second one, however, would have been sexual intercourse. The third would have been sexual orgasm, as in did he come Kamala. The hoped-for reply being I, say thank you, Kamala big big. To wet the Kamala is to irrigate the rice in a dry time. It is also to masturbate. Kamala is the commencement of some big and joyful meal, like a family feast. Not the meal itself, do you, but the moment of beginning to eat. A man who is losing his hair, as Garrett Strong was that season, is coming Kamala. Putting animals out to stud is damp Kamala. Gelded animals are dry Kamala, although no one could tell you why. A virgin is green Kamala. A menstruating woman is red Kamala. An old man who can no longer make iron before the forge is, say sorry, soft Kamala. To stand Kamala is to stand belly to belly, a slang term meaning to share secrets. The sexual connotations of the word are clear, but why should the rocky arroyos north of town be known as the Kamala Draws? For that matter, why is a fork sometimes a Kamala but never a spoon or a knife? There aren't 178 meanings for the word, but there must be 70. Twice that if one were to add in the various shadings. One of the meanings, it would surely be in the top 10, is that which Per Callahan defined as schmoozing. The actual phrase would be something like, come Sturgis Kamala, or come Brynna Kamala. The literal meaning would be to stand belly to belly with the community as a whole. During the following 5 days, Roland and his quartet attempted to continue this process which the outworlders had begun at Took's general store. The going was difficult at first, like trying to light a fire with damp kindling, Susanna said crossly after their first night. But little by little the folkin came around, or at least warmed up to them. Each night, Roland and the Deans returned to the pair's rectory. Each late afternoon or evening, Jake returned to the Rocking Bee Ranch. Andy took to meeting him at the place where the Bees Ranch Road split off from East Road and escorting him the rest of the way, each time making his bow and saying, "Good evening, so. Would you like your horoscope? This time of year is sometimes called Charureap. You will see an old friend. A young lady thinks of you warmly." And so on. Jake had asked Roland again why he was spending so much time with Benny Sleitman. "Are you complaining?" Roland asked. "Don't like him anymore?"
"I like him fine, Roland. But if there's something I'm supposed to be doing besides jumping in the hay, teaching Oi to do somersaults, or seeing who can skip a flat rock on the river the most times, I think you ought to tell me what it is."
"There's nothing else," Roland said. Then, as an afterthought, "and get your sleep. Growing boys need plenty of sleep."
"Why am I out there?"
"Because it seems right to me that you should be," Roland said. "All I want is for you to keep your eyes open and tell me if you see something you don't like or don't understand."
"Anyway, kiddo, don't you see enough of us during the days?"
Eddie asked him. They were together during those next 5 days, and the days were long. The novelty of riding Cy Overholzer's horses wore off in a hurry. So did complaints of sore muscles and blistered butts. On one of these rides, as they approached the place where Andy would be waiting, Roland asked Susanna bluntly if she had considered abortion as a way of solving her problem.
"Well," she said, looking at him curiously from her horse, "I'm not going to tell you the thought never crossed my mind."
"Banish it," he said. "No abortion."
"Any particular reason why not?"
"Ka," said Roland.
"Ka-ka," Eddie replied promptly. This was an old joke, but the three of them laughed, and Roland was delighted to laugh with him. And with that, the subject was dropped. Roland could hardly believe it, but he was glad. The fact that Susanna seemed so little disposed to discuss Mia and the coming of the baby made him grateful indeed. He supposed there were things, quite a few of them, which she felt better off not knowing. Still, she had never lacked for courage. Roland was sure the questions would have come sooner or later, but after 5 days of canvassing the town as a quintet counting Oi, who always rode with Jake, Roland began sending her out to the Jaffords' small hold at midday to try her hand with the dish. 8 days or so after their long palaver on the rectory porch, the one that had gone on until 4 in the morning, Susanna invited them out to the Jaffords' small hold to see her progress. "It's Zelia's idea," she said. "I guess she wants to know if I pass." Roland knew he only had to ask Susanna herself if he wanted an answer to that question, but he was curious. When they arrived, they found the entire family gathered on the back porch and several of Tien's neighbors as well. Borja Estrada and his wife, Diego Adams in chaps, the Javiers. They looked like spectators at a points practice. Zalman and Tia, the Runt twins, stood to one side, goggling at all the company with wide eyes. Andy was also there, holding baby Aaron, who was sleeping, in his arms.
"Roland, if you wanted all this kept secret, guess what?" Eddie said.
Roland was not put out of countenance, although he realized now that his threat to the cowboys who'd seen Cy Eisenhart throw the dish had been utterly useless. Country folk talked. That was all. Whether in the borderlands or the baronies, gossip was ever the chief sport, and at the very least, he mused, those humpies will spread the news that Roland's a hard boy, strong Kamala, and not to be trifled with. "It is what it is," he said. "The Kalafokan have known for donkey's years that the sisters of Oriza throw the dish. If they know Susanna throws it too, and well, maybe it's to the good." Jake said,
"I just hope she doesn't, you know, mess up."
There were respectful greetings for Roland, Eddie, and Jake as they mounted the porch. Andy told Jake a young lady was pining for him. Jake blushed and said he'd just as soon not know about stuff like that, if that did Andy all right.
"As you will, so."
Jake found himself studying the words and numbers stamped on Andy's midsection like a steel tattoo and wondering again if he was really in this world of robots and cowboys or if it was all some sort of extraordinarily vivid dream.
"I hope this baby will wake up soon, so I do, and cry, because I know several soothing cradle songs."
"Hush up, you creaking steel bandit,"
Grandpère said crossly, and after crying the old man's pardon, in his usual complacent, not a bit sorry tone of voice, Andy did. "Messenger? Many other functions?" Jake thought.
"Is one of your other functions teasing folks, Andy, or is that just my imagination?"
Susanna had gone into the house with Zelia. When they came out, Susanna was wearing not one reed pouch, but two. They hung to her hips on a pair of woven straps. There was another strap, too, Eddie saw, running around her waist and holding the pouches snug, like holster tie-downs.
"That's quite the hookup, say thank you," Diego Adams remarked.
"Susanna thought it up," Zelia said as Susanna got into her wheelchair. "She calls it a docker's clutch."
It wasn't, Eddie thought. Not quite, but it was close. He felt an admiring smile lift the corners of his mouth and saw a similar one on Roland's, and Jake's. By God, even Oi appeared to be grinning.
"Will it draw water, that's what I wonder," Bucky Javier said.
That such a question should even be asked, Eddie thought, only emphasized the difference between the gunslingers and the Kalafokan. Eddie and his mates had known from first look what the hookup was and how it would work. Javier, however, was a smallhold farmer and as such saw the world in a very different way.
"You need us," Eddie thought toward the little cluster of men standing on the porch, the farmers in their dirty white pants, Adams in his chaps and manure-splattered shore boots. "Boy, do you ever."
Susanna wheeled to the front of the porch and folded her stumps beneath her so she appeared almost to be standing in her chair.
Eddie knew how much this posture hurt her, but no discomfort showed on her face. Roland, meanwhile, was looking down into the pouches she wore. There were four dishes in each, plain things with no pattern on them. Practice dishes. Zelia walked across to the barn. Although Roland and Eddie had noted the blanket tacked up there as soon as they arrived, the others noticed it for the first time when Zelia pulled it down. Drawn in chalk on the barn boards was the outline of a man, or a man-like being, with a frozen grin on his face and the suggestion of a cloak fluttering out behind him. This wasn't work of the quality produced by the Tavery twins, nowhere near, but those on the porch recognized a wolf when they saw one. The older children oohed softly. The Estradas and the Javiers applauded, but looked apprehensive even as they did so, like people who fear they may be whistling up the devil. Andy complimented the artist, "whoever she may be," he added archly, and Grandpère told him again to shut his trap. Then he called out that the wolves he'd seen were quite a spot bigger. His voice was shrill with excitement. "Well, I drew it to man's size," Zelia said. She had actually drawn it to husband's size. "If the real thing turns out to make a bigger target, all to the good. Hear me, I beg?" This last came out uncertainly, almost as a question. Roland nodded. "We say thank you." Zelia shot him a grateful look, then stepped away from the outline on the wall. Then she looked at Susanna.
"When you will, lady."
For a moment, Susanna only remained where she was, about 60 yards from the barn. Her hands lay between her breasts, the right covering the left. Her head was lowered. Her comates knew exactly what was going on in that head. "I aim with my eye, shoot with my hand, kill with my heart." Their own hearts went out to her, perhaps carried by Jake's touch or Eddie's love, encouraging her, wishing her well, sharing their excitement. Roland watched fiercely. Would one more dab hand with the dish turn things in their favor? Perhaps not. But he was what he was, and so was she. And he wished her true aim with every last bit of his will. She raised her head, looked at the shape chalked on the barn wall. Still her hands lay between her breasts. Then she cried out shrilly, as Margaret Eisenhart had cried out in the yard of the Rocking Bee. And Roland felt his hard, beating heart rise. In that moment, he had a clear and beautiful memory of David, his hawk, folding his wings in a blue summer sky and dropping at his prey like a stone with eyes. "Riza!" Her hands dropped and became a blur. Only Roland, Eddie, and Jake were able to mark how they crossed at the waist, the right hand seizing a dish from the left pouch, the left hand seizing one from the right. Cy Eisenhart had thrown from the shoulder, sacrificing time in order to gain force and accuracy. Susanna's arms crossed below her ribcage and just above the arms of her wheelchair, the dishes finishing their cocking arc at about the height of her shoulder blades. Then they flew, crisscrossing in midair a moment before thudding into the side of the barn. Susanna's arms finished straight out before her. For a moment, she looked like an impresario who has just introduced the featured act. Then they dropped and crossed, seizing two more dishes. She flung them, dipped again, and flung the third set. The first two were still quivering when the last two bit into the side of the barn, one high and one low. For a moment, there was utter silence in the Jaffords' yard. Not even a bird called. The 8 plates ran in a perfectly straight line from the throat of the chalked figure to what would have been its upper midsection. They were all 2.5 to 3 inches apart, descending like buttons on a shirt, and she had thrown all 8 in no more than 3 seconds. "Do you mean to use the dish against the wolves?" Bucky Javier asked in a queerly breathless voice. "Is that it?"
"Nothing's been decided," Roland said stolidly. In a barely audible voice that held both shock and wonder, Dilly Estrada said,
"But if that had been a man, hear me, he'd be cutlets."
It was Grandpère who had the final word, as perhaps grandpères should.
"Ya bugger!"
6. On their way back out to the main road, Andy walked at a distance ahead of them, carrying the folded wheelchair and playing something bagpipey through his sound system.
Susanna said musingly, I may give up the gun altogether, Roland, and just concentrate on the dish. There's an elemental satisfaction to giving that scream and then throwing.
You reminded me of my hawk,
Roland admitted. Susanna's teeth flashed white in a grin. I felt like a hawk. Riser, oh, riser, just saying the word puts me in a throwing mood. To Jake's mind, this brought some obscure memory of Gasher.
Your old pal Gasher,
as the gentleman himself had been wont to say, and he shivered.
Would you really give up the gun? Roland asked. He didn't know if he was amused or aghast.
Would you roll your own smokes if you could get tailor-made's? She asked. And then before he could answer, no, not really. Yet the dish is a lovely weapon. When they come, I hope to throw 24 and bag my limit.
Will there be a shortage of plates? Eddie asked.
Nope, she said. There aren't very many fancy ones, like the one Cy Eisenhart threw for you, Roland. But they've hundreds of practice plates. Rosalita and Sari Adams are sorting through them, culling out any that might fly crooked. She hesitated, lowered her voice. They've all been out here, Roland. And although Sari's brave as a lion and would stand fast against a tornado,
hasn't got it, huh? Eddie asked sympathetically.
Not quite, Susanna agreed. She's good, but not like the others. Nor does she have quite the same ferocity.
I may have something else for her,
Roland said.
What would that be, sugar?
Escort duty, mayhap. We'll see how they shoot day after tomorrow. A little competition always livens things up. 5 o'clock, Susanna, do they know?
Yes, most of the Kala would turn up if you allowed them.
This was discouraging, but he should have expected it. I've been too long out of the world of people, he thought. So I have. No one but the ladies and ourselves,
Roland said firmly. If the Kalafokan saw the women throw well, it could swing a lot of people who are on the fence. Roland shook his head. He didn't want them to know how well the women threw. That was very nearly the whole point. But that the town knew they were throwing, that might not be such a bad thing.
How good are they, Susanna? Tell me.
She thought about it, then smiled. Killer aim, she said. Every one.
Can you teach them that cross-hand throw?
Susanna considered the question. You could teach anyone just about anything, given world enough and time, but they had neither. Only 13 days left now, and by the day the Sisters of Oriza, including their newest member, Susanna of New York, met for the exhibition in Per Callahan's backyard, there would be only a week and a half. The cross-hand throw had come naturally to her, as everything about shooting had, but the others... Rosalita will learn it, she said at last. Margaret Eisenhart could learn it, but she might get flustered at the wrong time. Zelia? No, best she throw one plate at a time, always with her right hand. She's a little slower, but I guarantee every plate she throws will drink something's blood.
Yeah, Eddie said, until a sneech homes in on her and blows her out of her corset, that is.
Susanna ignored this. We can hurt them, Roland. Thou knows we can.
Roland nodded. What he'd seen had encouraged him mightily, especially in light of what Eddie had told him. Susanna and Jake also knew Grandpere's ancient secret now, and speaking of Jake... You're very quiet today, Roland said to the boy. Is everything all right?
I do fine, thank you, Jake said. He had been watching Andy, thinking of how Andy had rocked the baby, thinking that if Tian and Zelia and the other kids all died and Andy was left to raise Aaron, baby Aaron would probably die within 6 months. Die or turn into the weirdest kid in the universe. Andy would diaper him, Andy would feed him all the correct stuff, Andy would change him when he needed changing and burp him if he needed burping, and there would be all sorts of cradle songs. Each would be sung perfectly, and none would be propelled by a mother's love. Or a father's. Andy was just Andy, messenger robot, many other functions. Baby Aaron would be better off being raised by, well, by wolves. This thought led him back to the night he and Benny had tented out. They hadn't done so since the weather had turned chilly. The night he had seen Andy and Benny's Da palavering. Then Benny's Da had gone wading across the river.
headed east. Headed in the direction of Thunderclap.
Jake, are you sure you're okay? Susanna asked.
Yes'm, Jake said.
Knowing this would probably make her laugh, it did. And Jake laughed with her, but he was still thinking of Benny's Da. The spectacles Benny's Da wore. Jake was pretty sure he was the only one in town who had them. Jake had asked him about that one day when the three of them had been riding in one of the Rocking Bee's two north fields, looking out strays. Benny's Da had told him a story about trading a beautiful, true-threaded colt for the specs from one of the Lake Mart boats it had been back when Benny's Sissa had been alive, Ariza bless her. He had done it even though all of the cowpokes, even Von Eisenhart himself, do you not see, had told him such spectacles never worked. They were no more useful than Andy's fortunes. But Ben Sleitman had tried them on, and they had changed everything. All at once, for the first time since he'd been maybe seven, he'd been able to really see the world. He had polished his specs on his shirt as they rode, held them up to the sky so that twin spots of light swam on his cheeks, then put them back on.
"If I ever lose 'em or break 'em, I don't know what I do," he'd said. "I got along without such just fine for 20 years or more, but a person gets used to something better in one rip of a hurry."
Jake thought it was a good story. He was sure Susanna would have believed it, assuming the singularity of Sleitman's spectacles had occurred to her in the first place. He had an idea Roland would have believed it, too. Sleitman told it in just the right way, a man who still appreciated his good fortune and didn't mind letting folks know that he'd been right about something while quite a number of other people, his boss among them, had been wide of the mark. Even Eddie might have swallowed it. The only thing wrong with Sleitman's story was that it wasn't true. Jake didn't know what the real deal was. His touch didn't go that deep, but he knew that much. And it worried him.
Probably nothing, you know. Probably he just got them in some way that wouldn't sound so good. For all you know, one of the Manny brought them back from some other world, and Benny's Da stole them.
That was one possibility. If pressed, Jake could have come up with half a dozen more. He was an imaginative boy. Still, when added to what he'd seen by the river, it worried him. What kind of business could Eisenhart's foreman have on the far side of the Y? Jake didn't know. And still, each time he thought to raise this subject with Roland, something kept him quiet. And after giving him a hard time about keeping secrets.
Yeah, but...
But what, little trailhand?
But Benny. That was what? Benny was the problem, or maybe it was Jake himself who was actually the problem. He'd never been much good at making friends, and now he had a good one, a real one. The thought of getting Benny's Die in trouble made him feel sick to his stomach.
7. 2 days later, at 5 o'clock, Rosalita, Zelia, Margaret Eisenhart, Sari Adams, and Susanna Dean gathered in the field just west of Rosa's neat privy. There were a lot of giggles and not a few bursts of nervous, shrieky laughter. Roland kept his distance and instructed Eddie and Jake to do the same. Best to let them get it out of their systems. Set against the rail fence, 10 feet apart from each other, were stuffies with plump, sharp-root heads. Each head was wrapped in a gunny sack, which had been tied to make it look like the hood of a cloak. At the foot of each guy were 3 baskets. One was filled with more sharp-root. Another was filled with potatoes. The contents of the third had elicited groans and cries of protest. These 3 were filled with radishes. Roland told them to quit their muling. He'd considered peas, he said. None of them, even Susanna, was entirely sure he was joking. Callahan, today dressed in jeans and a stockman's vest of many pockets, ambled out onto the porch where Roland sat smoking and waiting for the ladies to settle down. Jake and Eddie were playing draughts close by.
"Von Eisenhart's out front," the pair told Roland. "Says he'll go on down to Tookie's and have a beer, but not until he passes a word with ye."
Roland sighed
got up and walked through the house to the front. Eisenhart was sitting on the seat of a one-horse fly, shore boots propped on the splashboard, looking moodily off toward Callahan's church.
"Good day to you, Roland," he said.
Wayne Overholzer had given Roland a cowboy's broad-brimmed hat some days before. He tipped it to the rancher and waited.
"I guess you'll be sending the feather soon," Eisenhart said. "Calling a meeting, if it please you."
Roland allowed as how that was so. It was not the town's business to tell knights of Eld how to do their duty, but Roland would tell them what duty was to be done. That much he owed them.
"I want you to know that when the time comes, I'll touch it and send it on. And come the meeting, I'll say aye."
"Say thank you," Roland replied. He was, in fact, touched. Since joining with Jake, Eddie, and Susanna, it seemed his heart had grown. Sometimes he was sorry. Mostly he wasn't.
"Took won't do neither."
"No," Roland agreed. "As long as business is good, the Tooks of the world never touch the feather, nor say I."
"Overholzer's with him."
This was a blow. Not an entirely unexpected one, but he'd hoped Overholzer would come around. Roland had all the support he needed, however, and supposed Overholzer knew it. If he was wise, the farmer would just sit and wait for it to be over, one way or the other. If he meddled, he would likely not see another year's crops into his barns.
"I wanted you to know one thing," Eisenhart said. "I'm in with ye because of my wife, and my wife's in with ye because she's decided she wants to hunt. This is what all such things as the dish-throwing comes to in the end, a woman telling her man what'll be and what won't. It ain't the natural way. A man's meant to rule his woman, except in the matter of the babbies, of course."
"She gave up everything she was raised to when she took you to husband," Roland said. "Now it's your turn to give a little."
"Don't you think I know that? But if you get her killed, Roland, you'll take my curse with you when you leave the collar. If you do, no matter how many children you save."
Roland, who had been cursed before, nodded. "If Ka wills, Vaughn, she'll come back to you."
"Aye, but remember what I said."
"I will." Eisenhart slapped the reins on the horse's back, and the fly began to roll. 8. Each woman halved a sharp root head at 40 yards, 50 yards, and 60. "Hit the head as high up into the hood as you can get," Roland said. "Hitting them low will do no good."
"Armor, I suppose?" Rosalita asked.
"Aye," Roland said. Although that was not the entire truth. He wouldn't tell them what he now understood to be the entire truth until they needed to know it. Next came the taters. Sari Adams got hers at 40 yards, clipped it at 50, and missed entirely at 60. Her dish sailed high. She uttered a curse that was far from ladylike, then walked head down to the side of the privy. Here she sat to watch the rest of the competition. Roland went over and sat beside her. He saw a tear trickling from the corner of her left eye and down her wind-roughened cheek.
"I've let you down, stranger. Say sorry."
Roland took her hand and squeezed it. "Nay, lady, nay, there'll be work for you. Just not in the same place as these others. And you may yet throw the dish." She gave him a wan smile and nodded her thanks. Eddie put more sharp root heads on the stuffy guys, then a radish on top of each. The latter were all but concealed in the shadows thrown by the gunny sack hoods. "Good luck, girls," he said. "Better you than me." Then he stepped away. "Start from 10 yards this time," Roland called. At 10, they all hit. And at 20. At 30 yards, Susanna threw her plate high, as Roland had instructed her to do. He wanted one of the Kala women to win this round. At 40 yards, Zelia Jaffords hesitated too long, and the dish she flung chopped the sharp root head in two rather than the radish sitting on top.
"Fuck Kamala,"
she cried, then clapped her hands to her mouth and looked at Callahan, who was sitting on the back steps. That fellow only smiled and waved cheerfully, affecting deafness. She stamped over to Eddie and Jake, blushing to the tips of her ears and furious.
"You must tell him to give me another chance. Say, will you please?" she told Eddie. "I can do it. I know I can do it."
Eddie put a hand on her arm, stemming the flood.
He knows it too, Z.
You're in. She looked at him with burning eyes, lips pressed so tightly together they were almost gone.
Are you sure?
Yeah, Eddie said. You could pitch for the Mets, darling. Now it was down to Margaret and Rosalita. They both hit the radishes at 50 yards. To Jake, Eddie murmured, Buddy, I would have told you that was impossible if I hadn't just seen it. At 60 yards, Margaret Eisenhart missed cleanly. Rosalita raised her plate over her right shoulder, she was a lefty, hesitated, then screamed, Riza, and threw. Sharp-eyed though he was, Roland wasn't entirely sure if the plate's edge clipped the side of the radish or if the wind toppled it over. In either case, Rosalita raised her fists over her head and shook them, laughing. Fair day, goose, fair day, goose, Margaret began calling. The others joined in. Soon, even Callahan was chanting. Roland went to Rosa and gave her a hug, brief but strong. As he did so, he whispered in her ear that while he had no goose, he might be able to find a certain long-necked gander for her come evening.
Well, she said, smiling, when we get older, we take our prizes where we find them, don't we?
Celia glanced at Margaret.
What did he say to her? Did he ken it?
Margaret Eisenhart was smiling.
Nothing you haven't heard yourself, I'm sure, she said.
9. Then the ladies were gone. So was the pair on some errand or other. Roland of Gilead sat on the bottom porch step, looking downhill toward the site of the competition so lately completed. When Susanna asked him if he was satisfied, he nodded. Yes, I think all's well there. We have to hope it is because time's closing now. Things will happen fast. The truth was that he had never experienced such a confluence of events. But since Susanna had admitted her pregnancy, he had calmed, nevertheless. You've recalled the truth of Ka to your truant mind, he thought. And it happened because this woman showed a kind of bravery the rest of us couldn't quite muster up.
Roland, will I be going back out to the Rocking Bee?
Jake asked. Roland considered, then shrugged. Do you want to?
Yes, but this time I want to take the Ruger.
Jake's face pinked a little, but his voice remained steady. He had awakened with this idea as if the dream god, Roland called Nis, had brought it to him in his sleep.
I'll put it at the bottom of my bedroll and wrap it in my extra shirt. No one needs to know it's there.
He paused.
I don't want to show it off to Benny, if that's what you're thinking.
The idea had never crossed Roland's mind, but what was in Jake's mind? He posed the question, and Jake's answer was the sort one gives when one has charted the likely course of a discussion well in advance.
Do you ask as my dean?
Roland opened his mouth to say yes, saw how closely Eddie and Susanna were watching him, and reconsidered. There was a difference between keeping secrets, as each of them had in his own way kept the secret of Susanna's pregnancy, and following what Eddie called a hunch. The request under Jake's request was to be on a longer rope, simple as that. And surely Jake had earned the right to a little more rope. This was not the same boy who had come into Midworld shivering and terrified and nearly naked. Not as your din, he said. As for the Ruger, you may take it anywhere and at any time. Did you not bring it to the Tet in the first place?
Stole it,
Jake said in a low voice. He was staring at his knees.
You took what you needed to survive, Susanna said. There's a big difference. Listen, Sugar, you're not planning to shoot anyone, are you?
Not planning to, no.
Be careful, she said. I don't know what you've got in your head, but you be careful.
And whatever it is, you better get it settled in the next week or so, Eddie told him. Jake nodded, then looked at Roland.
When are you planning to call the town meeting?
According to the robot, we have 10 days left before the wolves come. So, Roland calculated briefly, town gathering in 6 days. Will that suit you? Jake nodded again. Are you sure you don't want to tell us what's on your mind?
Not unless you ask his din, Jake said. It's probably nothing, Roland. Really.
Roland nodded dubiously and began rolling another smoke. Having fresh tobacco was wonderful.
Is there anything else? Because if there isn't...
There is, actually, Eddie said.
What?
I need to go to New York, Eddie said. He spoke casually, as if proposing no more than a trip to the mercantile to buy a pickle or a licorice stick, but his eyes were dancing with excitement. And this time I'll have to go in the flesh, which means using the ball more directly, I guess. Black 13. I hope to hell you know how to do it, Roland.
Why do you need to go to New York? Roland asked. This I do ask as Din.
Sure you do, Eddie said, and I'll tell you. Because you're right about time getting short, and because the wolves of the Kala aren't the only ones we have to worry about. You want to see how close to July 15th it's getting, Jake said, don't you?
Yeah, Eddie said. We know from when we all went toe-dash that time is going faster in that version of New York, 1977. Remember the date on the piece of the New York Times I found in the doorway?
June 2nd, Susanna said.
Right. We're also pretty sure that we can't double back in time in that world. It's later every time we go there, right?
Jake nodded emphatically. Because that world's not like the others, unless maybe it was just being sent toe-dashed by Black 13 that made us feel that way.
I don't think so, Eddie said. That little piece of Second Avenue between the vacant lot and maybe on up to 60th is a very important place. I think it's a doorway, one big doorway.
Jake Chambers was looking more and more excited. Not all the way up to 60th. Not that far. Second Avenue between 46th and 54th. That's what I think. On the day I left Piper, I felt something change when I got to 54th Street. It's those eight blocks. The stretch with the record store on it, and Choo Choo Mama, and the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind, and the vacant lot, of course. That's the other end. I don't know.
Eddie said, being there takes you into a different world. Some kind of key world, and I think that's why time always runs one way.
Roland held up his hand. Stop. Eddie stopped, looking at Roland expectantly, smiling a little.
Roland was not smiling. Some of his previous sense of well-being had passed away. Too much to do, goddammit, and not enough time in which to do it. You want to see how near time has run to the day the agreement becomes null and void, he said. Have I got that right?
You do.
You don't need to go to New York physically to do that, Eddie. Toe-dash would serve nicely.
Toe-dash would do fine to check the day and the month, sure, but there's more. We've been dumb about that vacant lot, you guys. I mean, really dumb.
10. Eddie believed they could own the vacant lot without ever touching Susanna's inherited fortune. He thought Callahan's story showed quite clearly how it could be done. Not the rose. The rose was not to be owned by them or anyone, but to be protected. And they could do it. Maybe. Frightened or not, Calvin Tower had been waiting in that deserted laundromat to save Pere Callahan's bacon, and frightened or not, Calvin Tower had refused, as of May 31st, 1977 anyway, to sell his last piece of real property to the Sombra Corporation. Eddie thought that Calvin Tower was, in the words of the song, holding out for a hero. Eddie had also been thinking about the way Callahan had hidden his face in his hands the first time he mentioned Black 13. He wanted it the hell out of his church, but so far he'd kept it anyway. Like the bookshop owner, the pair had been holding out. How stupid they had been to assume Calvin Tower would ask millions for his lot. He wanted to be shed of it. But not until the right person came along, or the right quartet.
Susiella, you can't go because you're pregnant, Eddie said. Jake, you can't go because you're a kid. All other questions aside, I'm pretty sure you couldn't sign the kind of contract I've been thinking about ever since Callahan told us his story. I could take you with me, but it sounds like you've got something you want to check into over here, or am I wrong about that?
You're not wrong, Jake said. But I'd almost go with you anyway. This sounds really good.
Eddie smiled. Almost only counts with grenades and horseshoes, kid. As for sending Roland, no offense, boss, but you're not all that suave in our world. You, lose something in the translation.
Susanna burst out laughing. How much are you thinking of offering him? Jake asked. I mean, it has to be something, doesn't it?
A buck, Eddie said. I'll probably have to ask Tower to loan it to me, but
No, we can do better than that, Jake said, looking serious. I've got $5 or $6 in my knapsack, I'm pretty sure. He grinned. And we can offer him more later on, when things kind of settle down on this side.
If we're still alive, Susanna said, but she also looked excited. You know what, Eddie? You just might be a genius.
Balazar and his friends won't be happy if Psi Tower sells us his lot, Roland said.
Yeah, but maybe we can persuade Balazar to leave him alone, Eddie said.
A grim little smile was playing around the corners of his mouth.
When it comes right down to it, Roland, Enrico Balazar's the kind of guy I wouldn't mind killing twice.
When do you want to go? Susanna asked him.
The sooner the better, Eddie said. For one thing, not knowing how late it is over there in New York is driving me nuts. Roland, what do you say?
I say tomorrow, Roland said. We'll take the ball up to the cave, and then we'll see if you can go through the door to Calvin Towers where and when. Your idea's a good one, Eddie, and I say thank you.
Jake said, what if the ball sends you to the wrong place? The wrong version of 1977, or...
He hardly knew how to finish. He was remembering how thin everything had seemed when Black 13 had first taken them Todash, and how endless darkness seemed to be waiting behind the painted surface realities around them.
Or someplace even farther, he finished. In that case, I'll send back a postcard.
Eddie said it with a shrug and a laugh, but for just a moment, Jake saw how frightened he was.
Susanna must have seen it too, because she took Eddie's hand in both of hers and squeezed it.
Hey, I'll be fine, Eddie said.
You better be, Susanna replied. You just better.
Chapter 2 The Dogon, Part 1 1 When Roland and Eddie entered Our Lady of Serenity the following morning, daylight was only a distant rumor on the northeast horizon. Eddie lit their way down the center aisle with a senior, his lips pressed tightly together. The thing they had come for was humming. It was a sleepy hum, but he hated the sound of it just the same. The church itself felt freaky. Empty, it seemed too big somehow. Eddie kept expecting to see ghostly figures, or perhaps a complement of the vagrant dead sitting in the pews and looking at them with otherworldly disapproval. But the hum was worse. When they reached the front, Roland opened his purse and took out the bowling bag which Jake had kept in his knapsack until yesterday. The gunslinger held it up for a moment, and they could both read what was printed on the side, "Nothing but strikes at Midworld Lanes." "Not a word from now until I tell you it's all right," Roland said. "Do you understand?"
"Yes."
Roland pressed his thumb into the groove between two of the floorboards, and the hidey hole in the preacher's cove sprang open. He lifted the top aside. Eddie had once seen a movie on TV about guys disposing of live explosives during the London Blitz, UXB it had been called, and Roland's movements now recalled that film strongly to his mind. And why not? If they were right about what was in this hiding place, and Eddie knew they were, then it was an unexploded bomb. Roland folded back the white linen surplice, exposing the box. The hum rose. Eddie's breath stopped in his throat. He felt the skin all over his body grow cold. Somewhere close, a monster of nearly unimaginable malevolence had half opened one sleeping eye. The hum dropped back to its former sleepy pitch, and Eddie breathed again. Roland handed him the bowling bag, motioning for Eddie to hold it open. With misgivings, part of him wanted to whisper in Roland's ear that they should forget the whole thing. Eddie did as he was bidden. Roland lifted the box out, and once again the hum rose. In the rich, if limited, glow of the scener, Eddie could see sweat on the gunslinger's brow. He could feel it on his own. If Black 13 awoke and pitched them out into some black limbo, "I won't go. I'll fight to stay with Susanna." Of course he would. But he was still relieved when Roland slipped the elaborately carved ghostwood box into the queer metallic bag they'd found in the vacant lot. The hum didn't disappear entirely, but subsided to a barely audible drone, and when Roland gently pulled the drawstring running around the top of the bag, closing its mouth, the drone became a distant whisper.
It was like listening to a seashell. Eddie sketched the sign of the cross in front of himself. Smiling faintly, Roland did the same. Outside the church, the northeast horizon had brightened appreciably. There would be real daylight after all, it seemed. Roland? The gunslinger turned toward him, eyebrows raised. His left fist was closed around the bag's throat. He was apparently not willing to trust the weight of the box to the bag's drawstring, stout as it looked. If we were Toadash when we found that bag, how could we have picked it up? Roland considered this. Then he said, perhaps the bag is Toadash too. Still? Roland nodded. Yes, I think so. Still. Oh. Eddie thought about it. That's spooky. Changing your mind about revisiting New York, Eddie? Eddie shook his head. He was scared, though. Probably more scared than he'd been at any time since standing up in the aisle of the Barony coach to Riddle Blaine. 2. By the time they were halfway along the path leading to the doorway cave, it's upsy, Henchik had said, and so it had been, and so it was. It was easily 10 o'clock and remarkably warm. Eddie stopped, wiped the back of his neck with his bandana, and looked out over the twisting arroyos to the north. Here and there he could see black, gaping holes, and asked Roland if they were the Garnet Mines. The gunslinger told him they were. And which one have you got in mind for the kiddies? Can we see it from here? As a matter of fact, yes. Roland drew the single gun he was wearing and pointed it. Look over the side. Eddie did, and saw a deep draw which made the shape of a jagged double S. It was filled to the top with velvety shadows. He guessed there might be only half an hour or so at midday when the sun reached the bottom. Farther to the north, it appeared to dead-end against a massive rock face. He supposed the mine entrance was there, but it was too dark to make out. To the southeast, this arroyo opened on a dirt track that wound its way back to East Road. Beyond East Road were fields sloping down to fading but still green plots of rice. Beyond the rice was the river. "Makes me think of the story you told us," Eddie said. "I Bolt Canyon."
"Of course it does."
"No Finney to do the dirty work, though."
"No," Roland agreed. "No Finney."
"Tell me the truth. Are you really going to stick this town's kids in a mine at the end of a dead-end arroyo?"
"No."
"The Falcon think you... that we mean to do that. Even the dish-throwing ladies think that."
"I know they do," Roland said. "I want them to."
"Why?"
"Because I don't believe there's anything supernatural about the way the wolves find the children. After hearing Grandpère Jafford's story, I don't think there's anything supernatural about the wolves, for that matter. No, there's a rat in this particular corn crib. Someone who goes squealing to the powers that be in Thunderclap."
"Someone different each time, you mean? Each 23 or 24 years?"
"Yes."
"Who'd do that?" Eddie asked. "Who could do that?"
"I'm not sure, but I have an idea."
"Took? Kind of a handed-down thing from father to son?"
"If you're rested, Eddie, I think we'd better press on."
"Overholzer? Maybe that guy Telford, the one who looks like a TV cowboy?" Roland walked past him without speaking, his new shore boots gritting on the scattered pebbles and rock splinters. From his good left hand, the pink bag swung back and forth. The thing inside was still whispering its unpleasant secrets. "Chatty as ever, good for you," Eddie said, and followed him.
3. The first voice which arose from the depths of the cave belonged to the great sage and eminent junkie.
"Oh, look at the widow sissy," Henry moaned. To Eddie he sounded like Ebenezer Scrooge's dead partner in A Christmas Carol, funny and scary at the same time. "Does the widow sissy think he's going back to Newark? You'll go a lot farther than that if you try it, bro. Better hunker where you are. Just do your little carvings. Be a good little homo."
The dead brother laughed. The live one shivered. "Eddie?" Roland asked.
"Listen to your brother, Eddie," his mother cried from the cave's dark and sloping throat. On the rock floor, scatters of small bones gleamed.
He gave up his life for you, his whole life. The least you could do is listen to him.
Eddie, are you all right?
Now came the voice of Csaba Drabnik, known in Eddie's crowd as the mad fucking Hungarian. Csaba was telling Eddie to give him a cigarette or he'd pull Eddie's fucking pants down. Eddie tore his attention away from this frightening but fascinating gabble with an effort.
Yeah, he said, I guess so.
The voices are coming from your own head. The cave finds them and amplifies them somehow, sends them on. It's a little upsetting, I know, but it's meaningless.
Why'd you let him kill me, bro? Henry sobbed. I kept thinking you'd come, but you never did.
Meaningless, Eddie said. Okay, got it. What do we do now?
According to both stories I've heard of this place, Callahan's and Henchick's, the door will open when I open the box.
Eddie laughed nervously.
I don't even want you to take the box out of the bag. How's that for chicken shit?
If you've changed your mind, Eddie was shaking his head.
No, I want to go through with it.
He flashed a sudden, bright grin.
You're not worried about me scoring, are you? Finding the man and getting high?
From deep in the cave, Henry exulted.
It's China White, bro. Them niggers sell the best.
Not at all, Roland said. There are plenty of things I'm worried about, but you returning to your old habits isn't one of them.
Good. Eddie stepped a little farther into the cave, looking at the freestanding door. Except for the hieroglyphics on the front and the crystal knob with the rose etched on it, this one looked exactly like the ones on the beach.
If you go around, the door's gone, Roland said. There is a hell of a drop-off, though. All the way to Gnaw, for all I know. I'd mind that if I were you.
Good advice and fast, Eddie says thank you.
He tried the crystal doorknob and found it wouldn't budge in either direction. He had expected that, too. He stepped back.
Roland said, You need to think of New York. Of Second Avenue in particular, I think, and of the time. The year of 1977.
How do you think of a year?
When Roland spoke, his voice betrayed a touch of impatience.
Think of how it was on the day you and Jake followed Jake's earlier self, I suppose.
Eddie started to say that was the wrong day, it was too early, then closed his mouth. If they were right about the rules, he couldn't go back to that day, not Todesh, not in the flesh either. If they were right, time over there was somehow hooked to time over here, only running a little faster. If they were right about the rules, if there were rules, well, why don't you just go and see?
Eddie, do you want me to try hypnotizing you?
Roland had drawn a shell from his gun belt. It can make you see the past more clearly.
No, I think I better do this straight and wide awake.
Eddie opened and closed his hands several times, taking and releasing deep breaths as he did so. His heart wasn't running particularly fast, was going slow, if anything, but each beat seemed to shiver through his entire body. Christ, all this would have been so much easier if there were just some controls you could set, like in Professor Peabody's Wayback Machine or that movie about the Morlocks.
Hey, do I look all right? He asked Roland. I mean, if I land on Second Avenue at high noon, how much attention am I going to attract?
If you appear in front of people, Roland said, probably quite a lot. I'd advise you to ignore anyone who wants to palaver with you on the subject and vacate the area immediately.
That much I know. I meant, how do I look clothes-wise?
Roland gave a small shrug. I don't know, Eddie. It's your city, not mine.
Eddie could have demurred. Brooklyn was his city. Had been, anyway. As a rule, he hadn't gone into Manhattan from one month to the next, thought of it almost as another country. Still, he supposed he knew what Roland meant. He inventoried himself and saw a plain flannel shirt with horn buttons above dark blue jeans with burnished nickel rivets instead of copper ones and a button-up fly. Eddie had seen zippers in Ludd, but none since. He reckoned he would pass for normal on the street. New York normal, at least. Anyone who gave him a second look would think cafe waiter, artist wannabe playing hippie on his day off. He didn't think most people would even bother with the first look, and that was absolutely to the good. But there was one thing he could add. "Have you got a piece of rawhide?" he asked Roland. From deep in the cave,
the voice of Mr. Tubther, his fifth-grade teacher, cried out with lugubrious intensity, "You had potential. You were a wonderful student, and look at what you turned into. Why did you let your brother spoil you?" To which Henry replied, in sobbing outrage, "He let me die. He killed me." Roland swung his purse off his shoulder, put it on the floor at the mouth of the cave beside the pink bag, opened it, rummaged through it. Eddie had no idea how many things were in there. He only knew he'd never seen the bottom of it. At last, the gunslinger found what Eddie had asked for and held it out. While Eddie tied back his hair with the hank of rawhide, he thought it finished off the artistic hippie look quite nicely, Roland took out what he called his swag bag, opened it, and began to empty out its contents. There was the partially depleted sack of tobacco Callahan had given him, several kinds of coin and currency, a sewing kit, the mended cup he had turned into a rough compass not far from Shardock's clearing, an old scrap of map, and the newer one the Tavery twins had drawn. When the bag was empty, he took the big revolver with the sandalwood grip from the holster on his left hip. He rolled the cylinder, checked the loads, nodded, and snapped the cylinder back into place. Then he put the gun into the swag bag, yanked the lacings tight, and tied them in a clove hitch that would come loose at a single pull. He held the bag out to Eddie by the worn strap. At first, Eddie didn't want to take it. "Nah, man, that's yours. These last weeks you've worn it as much as I have. Probably more." "Yeah, but this is New York we're talking about, Roland. In New York, everybody steals." "They won't steal from you. Take the gun." Eddie looked into Roland's eyes for a moment, then took the swag bag and slung the strap over his shoulder.
"You've got a feeling?"
"A hunch, yes."
"Ka at work?"
Roland shrugged. "It's always at work."
"All right," Eddie said. "And Roland, if I don't make it back, take care of Sue's."
"Your job is to make sure I don't have to."
"No," Eddie thought, "my job is to protect the Rose."
He turned to the door. He had 1,000 more questions, but Roland was right. The time to ask them was done. "Eddie, if you really don't want to—"
"No," he said, "I do want to."
He raised his left hand and gave a thumbs up.
"When you see me do that, open the box."
"All right." Roland speaking from behind him, because now it was just Eddie in the door. The door with "unfound" written on it in some strange and lovely language. Once he'd read a novel called The Door into Summer by who? One of the science fiction guys he was always dragging home from the library, one of his old reliables, perfect for the long afternoons of summer vacation, Murray Leinster, Poole Anderson, Gordon Dixon, Isaac Asimov, Harlan Ellison, Robert Heinlein. He thought it was Heinlein who'd written The Door into Summer. Henry always ragging him about the books he brought home, calling him the whittle sissy, the whittle bookworm, asking him if he could read and jerk off at the same time, wanting to know how he could sit fucking still for so long with his nose stuck in some made-up piece of shit about rockets and time machines. Henry older than him, Henry covered with pimples that were always shiny with Noxzema and Stridex. Henry getting ready to go into the army. Eddie, younger, Eddie bringing books home from the library, Eddie 13 years old, almost the age Jake is now. It's 1977, and he's 13, and on 2nd Avenue, and the taxis are shiny yellow in the sun. A black man wearing Walkman earphones is walking past Choo Choo Mamas. Eddie can see him. Eddie knows the black man is listening to Elton John singing, "What else? Someone saved my life tonight." The sidewalk is crowded. It's late afternoon and people are going home after another day in the steel arroyos of Kala, New York, where they grow money instead of rice, can you say prime rate? Women looking amiably weird in expensive business suits and sneakers. Their high heels are in their gunna because the workday is done, and they're going home. Everyone seems to be smiling because the light is so bright and the air is so warm. It's summer in the city, and somewhere there's the sound of a jackhammer, like on that old Lovin' Spoonful song. Before him is a door into the summer of 77. The cabbies are getting a buck and a quarter on the drop and 30 cents every fifth of a mile thereafter. It was less before, and it'll be more after, but this is now, the dancing point of now. The space shuttle with the teacher on board hasn't blown up. John Lennon is still alive, although he won't be much longer if he doesn't stop messing with that wicked heroine, that China White.
As for Eddie Dean, Edward Cantor Dean, he knows nothing about heroin. A few cigarettes are his only vice, other than trying to jack off, at which he will not be successful for almost another year. He's 13. It's 1977, and he has exactly 4 hairs on his chest. He counts them religiously each morning, hoping for big number 5. It's the summer after the summer of the tall ships. It's a late afternoon in the month of June, and he can hear a happy tune. The tune is coming from the speakers over the doorway of the Tower of Power record shop. It's Mungo Jerry singing In the Summertime, and suddenly it was all real to him, or as real as he thought he needed it to be. Eddie raised his left hand and popped up his thumb. Let's go. Behind him, Roland had sat down and eased the box out of the pink bag, and when Eddie gave him the thumbs up, the gunslinger opened the box. Eddie's ears were immediately assaulted by a sweetly dissonant jangle of chimes. His eyes began to water. In front of him, the freestanding door clicked open, and the cave was suddenly illuminated by strong sunlight. There was the sound of beeping horns and the rat-a-tat-tat of a jackhammer. Not so long ago, he had wanted a door like this so badly that he'd almost killed Roland to get it. And now that he had it, he was scared to death. The toad-ass chimes felt as if they were tearing his head apart. If he listened to that for long, he'd go insane. Go if you're going, he thought. He stepped forward, through his gushing eyes, seeing 3 hands reach out and grasp 4 doorknobs. He pulled the door toward him, and golden late-day sunlight dazzled his eyes. He could smell gasoline and hot city air and someone's aftershave. Hardly able to see anything, Eddie stepped through the unfound door and into the summer of a world from which he was now fan-gone, the exiled one. 4. It was Second Avenue, all right. Here was the Blimpies, and from behind him came the cheery sound of that Mungo Jerry song with the Caribbean beat. People moved around him in a flood, uptown, downtown, all around the town. They paid no attention to Eddie, partly because most of them were only concentrating on getting out of town at the end of another day, mostly because in New York, not noticing other people was a way of life. Eddie shrugged his right shoulder, settling the strap of Roland's swag bag there more firmly, then looked behind him. The door back to Calabrin Sturgis was there. He could see Roland sitting at the mouth of the cave with the box open on his lap. Those fucking chimes must be driving him crazy, Eddie thought. And then, as he watched, he saw the gunslinger remove a couple of bullets from his gun belt and stick them in his ears. Eddie grinned. Good move, man. At least it had helped to block out the warble of the thinny back on I-70. Whether it worked now or whether it didn't, Roland was on his own. Eddie had things to do. He turned slowly on his little spot on the sidewalk, then looked over his shoulder again to verify the door had turned with him. It had. If it was like the other ones, it would now follow him everywhere he went. Even if it didn't, Eddie didn't foresee a problem. He wasn't planning on going far. He noticed something else as well. That sense of darkness lurking behind everything was gone. Because he was really here, he supposed, and not just Todash. If there were vagrant dead lurking in the vicinity, he wouldn't be able to see them. Once more, shrugging the swag bag strapped further up on his shoulder, Eddie set off for the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. 5. People moved aside for him as he walked, but that wasn't quite enough to prove he was really here. People did that when you were Todash, too. At last, Eddie provoked an actual collision with a young guy toting not one briefcase, but 2, a big coffin hunter of the business world, if Eddie had ever seen one.
Hey, watch where you're going, Mr. Businessman squawked when their shoulders collided. Sorry, man, sorry, Eddie said.
He was here, all right.
Say, could you tell me what they...
But Mr. Businessman was already gone, chasing the coronary he'd probably catch up to around the age of 45 or 50, from the look of him. Eddie remembered the punchline of an old New York joke. Pardon me, sir, can you tell me how to get to City Hall, or should I just go fuck myself? He burst out laughing, couldn't help it. Once he had himself back under control, he got moving again. On the corner of 2nd and 54th, he saw a man looking into a shop window at a display of shoes and boots.
This guy was also wearing a suit, but looked considerably more relaxed than the one Eddie had bumped into. Also, he was carrying only a single briefcase, which Eddie took to be a good omen.
"Cry your pardon," Eddie said, "but could you tell me what day it is?"
"Thursday," the window shopper said, "the 23rd of June."
1977?
The window shopper gave Eddie a little half-smile, both quizzical and cynical, plus a raised eyebrow.
1977, that's correct. Won't be 1978 for, gee, another 6 months. Think of that.
Eddie nodded.
"Thank you, Si." "Thank you what?"
"Nothing,"
Eddie said, and hurried on. Only 3 weeks to July 15th, give or take, he thought. That's cutting it too goddamn close for comfort. Yes, but if he could persuade Calvin Tower to sell him the lot today, the whole question of time would be moot. Once, a long time ago, Eddie's brother had boasted to some of his friends that his little bro could talk the devil into setting himself on fire, if he really set his mind to it. Eddie hoped he still had some of that persuasiveness. Do a little deal with Calvin Tower, invest in some real estate, then maybe take a half-hour time out and actually enjoy that New York groove a little bit. Celebrate. Maybe get a chocolate egg cream, or... The run of his thoughts broke off, and he stopped so suddenly that someone bumped into him and then swore. Eddie barely felt the bump or heard the curse. The dark gray Lincoln town car was parked up there again. Not in front of the fire hydrant this time, but a couple of doors down. Balazar's town car. Eddie started walking again. He was suddenly glad Roland had talked him into taking one of his revolvers, and that the gun was fully loaded.